Hi, I'm Paul Lisnick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain, where we lift the curtain on politics and theater. You know, two areas a lot of people think don't ever meet, but here they do. As the political analyst for WGN-TV and host of CLTV's Politics Tonight and Broadway in Chicago Backstage on the Comcast Network, we'll touch on everything from national, international, state, and local politics to the artistic side of our city. We're going to feature the hottest shows and theaters because when it comes to theater, New York, watch your back. Chicago gets it right. Plus, we'll look at other social and legal issues of interest to you each week, hoping to spark a little interest, ensure meaning towards the bigger picture, and maybe even spread some knowledge along the way. Get ready, everybody. We're going to raise the curtain. We're looking behind and underneath the scenes. Let's get to it. I don't think it matters how many years ago we put the Holocaust in time. Many decades have passed, and many of the survivors who lived through that atrocity have passed as well. But fortunately, there are several still with us and still around who have their story to tell. And it's important that they tell their story for the mantra, if you will, that we must never forget what happened and never permit something like the Holocaust ever to happen again. Joining me now is Fritzi Fritschel, an incredible woman who lived through her time at Auschwitz-Birkenau extermination camp, lived to talk about it, and is joining us now to talk about her story with us. Fritzi, you and I have talked before and met before, and I welcome you back to chatting with me.
Well, thank you. I think it's very nice of you to do this. This is an important story. This is something, you're absolutely right. This is a story that needs to be told over and over and over again, never to be forgotten.
Fritzi, you were born in Czechoslovakia, and all of this happened when you were about 13 years old. Tell me just in a sentence or two, what was your life like for the first 12 years of your life before this horror came into it?
You know, I keep telling people that I've had three lives. I've had life before, life during, and life after. The life before was wonderful. It was a normal childhood. I was one of three children, and what is normal in a home? We were in a loving, wonderful home. I was raised in an Orthodox home, and I thought life was wonderful.
And one day, Fritzi, the Nazis came and knocked on your door.
The Nazis came during the last days of Passover. It was in the middle of the night, and the knock came in the middle of the night, and I remember my mother getting up and her three children around her, my two younger brothers, and myself, and being scared of the unknown. And we were told to gather our belongings and take pots and pans, to take warm clothes, to make sure we took our valuables, and we were going to be relocated. The word was relocated. You need to understand, we didn't have CNN. We didn't have the cell phones. The newspapers gave us whatever they wanted to give us at that point, the Nazi newspapers already. Radios were taken away from us. And so we knew there was going to be a final solution, but we didn't know what the final solution was going to be. So they lied. We believed we were going to be relocated to a good place. Obviously, it didn't turn out that way.
And of course, you had to believe, because that would have been the only source of hope to even take the steps you took. Tell me about your journey. You were sent to Auschwitz, and you were sent, and I remember, in a train, in a boxcar. Talk to me about that journey, because it was horrific.
You know, those of you that have been to the Illinois Holocaust Museum, we have an actual boxcar. A boxcar like the one the Jews were taken all through Europe into the concentration camps. I can walk to that museum all day long, but the memory of being in that boxcar, being pushed in from a ghetto, being hungry already, not having had a shower, just being pushed in with other Jews that were taken from other communities, the boxcar was so full that we literally had to stand. To me, to this day, I have never gotten over the memory and the fear of being in that boxcar. I smell it. I see it. I feel it. I see a mother holding a dead baby. I see my grandfather dying in that boxcar with us. I see mothers just giving up from hunger and thirst and just keeling over. The bucket that was put in the center of this compartment was there to be used as toilet. And as the car moved, as the train moved, the bucket was full and it also overflowed. And we were standing in that as well. It is no way to stand or try and describe the horror of that boxcar going to Auschwitz concentration camp. By the time we came to Auschwitz, the babies were dead. The old people were dying. The pregnant women were dying. People were fainting. And it was just unbelievable.
How long was that ride?
To me, the ride was forever. I don't know. It was 2 days, maybe 3 days. I don't know. But it was a forever ride, and I'm still riding it.
And you arrived at the camp, and you got off. Were you at this point thinking we're being relocated? Did you have any hope, or was hope gone by that moment?
Hope was always there. Hope was there that maybe we are going to get there. Maybe some of us are going to live. Maybe we are going to a decent place. So hope was always there. When we came to Auschwitz-Birkenau and the doors opened, we came there in the middle of the night. And you need to sort of visualize this. We are in a dark compartment, and the doors opened, and bright, bright lights are being shined into this compartment. We are greeted by SS men standing with guns pointing at us. We are greeted with SS women in uniform holding on to dogs that are trying to get at us. There are all kinds of orders being shouted at us in a language most of us don't understand. If you speak Yiddish, if you speak Jewish, you could understand some of it, but most people didn't. And I remember two men standing in front of each compartment, our compartment as well, who were dirty and skinny and had shaved and wearing uniforms. They came onto our compartment to try and get us off as fast as they could. They were Jews that were brought there before us. They already knew what was going to happen to us. We did not. They walked amongst children like myself, saved many children's lives by risking their own lives, by whispering in Yiddish and Jewish, "You're 15, remember, when you get off, you're 15. They knew that most children under the age of 15 would line up, being separated from their parents and being taken to the gas chambers. I was 13 years old when we got off. I did not go with the children. I went with the adults because I am now 15. I'm not 13 any longer as when I got on. And so I went with the adults. After the separation, people don't realize what it was like, the separation, the families torn apart, the children being dragged away from a parent, the mothers and fathers and grandparents, everybody separated, everybody put into a different line. But the shouting and the fear that was happening during that particular time, watching people being punished already and seeing the guns and the dogs. And so my brothers were taken with the children. My mother and I lined up with the women. I am now lying about my age. I'm 15 instead of 13. My grandmother was taken away from us. And so they kept walking around, the Germans kept walking around and calling age. And I remember telling my mother she was in the wrong line. And they took her into a different line. The line she went into was taken away, marched away. When I asked several hours later when I would see my mother, they showed me the smoke. This has been a heavy burden to carry all my life, because would she, could she have lived through the camp if she had gone to the concentration camp with me? Chances are she would not have lived, but I don't know that for sure. And so...
And it's a question that you have lived with forever. One of the things I remember when I first met you in person, we talked about the numbers that were put on every Jewish person's arm because the Nazis were meticulous in keeping records. You don't have a number. Why?
I don't have a number and did not know for many, many, many years why, until I revisited Auschwitz several years later. The lady that was in charge of Birkenau camp, who was a Polish lady at the time, took us on the lookout post, and this was maybe 12, 15 years ago, and actually pointed out the barrack that I was in. And she explained that when my transport came to Birkenau, the camp was so full that most of the people from my transport were going directly to the gas chambers. Somehow or other, some of us fell through the cracks. I was one of the people that fell through the cracks and was never, ever tattooed, as were the rest. But I never understood of why. And there are maybe a handful of women that are living that have not been tattooed during that time.
You know, many filmmakers, Steven Spielberg and others, through their films, have tried to share with the world what the Holocaust was like. The question I want to ask you is, do we get any realistic sense of it? But first I have to ask you, do you even sit through any of those movies that have been made about the Holocaust?
You know, I do watch them because it's like a criminal returning to the scene of the crime, and there's that curiosity. And I watch it and I go, what are you talking about? Why? What are you showing us? This could never have happened in a camp. They make a love story and a ha-ha out of those movies. And some of them, what the Spielberg film did is it called attention to what happened. And it did bring the attention to the world and as to others. And yes, I do watch them, but it is never like a camp. There's no way for anyone to stand and explain even an hour in a concentration camp. There's just no way. You may talk to 4 survivors or a dozen survivors who were in the same spot at the same time and saw and felt and went through different things, because things were constantly happening and survival was always the focal point. So it was, I remember accompanying at the time Quinn, who was our governor at the time.
Yes.
I accompanied the governor and a delegation from Chicago to Auschwitz-Birkenau. I remember the governor standing in Birkenau and looking around and looking at us, and I'm going to quote him as much as I can. He said, I have read, I have seen films, I have met survivors, but unless you stand on these grounds, you will never understand and never know. And the truth of the matter is that we survivors don't understand it either.
I've been to Auschwitz myself, and it is something I'll never forget. In fact, one of the things I found striking, Fritzi, I could still smell the burning. It's still there. Have you heard that from others? Did you experience that yourself?
I have been back several times because I have taken groups back. It's called education. And I walk in, and I'm still afraid to walk on the ground. That blood will squirt up. I'm afraid I'm walking on bones. I am afraid of what's going to come at me. The smell is dead and everything. It will never, ever, ever go away. And this is what I don't understand. The towns around them I mean, those ovens, the smell was day and night, day and night. People, they were burning flesh. They were burning people. They claimed they didn't know. How could they possibly not have known?
Did you have any sense? You know, I sometimes think about these German soldiers who became prison guards, and I thought, like you, they were just living life. They were having their, until this war began, until they got wrapped up. Have you ever been able to figure out what it is that happened to those minds? You know, this is not like a deranged killer that you know, one person. These are thousands and thousands of people who bought into, whether it's Hitler's philosophy or whatever it was. What do you think got them? Was it power? What turned them?
I think a lot of it was power. A lot of it was propaganda. The Jews were the bad people, and we were known as the vermin, and we were called all kinds of names. And, you know, going back to that, exactly what you said, those soldiers, those Nazis that were in charge of the camps went home to their families with blood on their hands. Blood on their hands. They went to their children. And to bring the point that people didn't know. You know, this was not done by one or two or 100 or 1,000 people. This was done all through Europe. These were the people that gathered the Jews, the people that pointed out the Jews, the people that drove the trains, the people that arrested the Jews and into the ghettos and brought the food into the ghettos, the little bit of food that was brought. The perpetrators, the bystanders, these were all the people that knew and saw and turned their back on humanity. Humanity. They turned their back on children. Why? Why? We were not the criminals. We didn't do anything. We didn't kill anyone. Yes, we were born a Jew. But I remember as a child, my friends were not Jewish. My best friends were not Jewish. I remember their parents going to church. I remember even walking into a church with my friend just to see what it was like. I never felt different. To this day, I don't understand. We respected everyone's religion in our community. And until Hitler came, I thought everyone respected me and my religion as well. And the world just turned upside down.
I don't know if you are a religious person or ever were, but I guess I feel like I need to ask the question. People say, how could God let this happen? So I have to ask you, do you believe in God? Did you believe in God? Do you believe in God?
This is a heavy question to answer. I need to tell you that I was raised in an Orthodox home. I was raised in a home where I watched my grandfather saying his prayers every morning and laying tefillin, which is, I don't know how to explain that.
It's a Jewish ritual.
Yes. And yes, I was raised in a religious home. When I came to Auschwitz, I lost it. I felt that God said, he or she sat on the fence and looked down at his people, and we were forsaken. We were totally forsaken during the time of the Holocaust. How can you believe in something when you watch children walking to the gas chambers? How can you believe that there is a God? And yes, I am a believer today. I came out believing in a different way. I believe that there is a creator. And I have my arguments with God. I when things don't go right, I look up and I go, you looked down at me once, but you owe me now. So I talk to God. Is there a God? I don't know. But I think we all need someone, something to hold on to and to believe. And that's part of humanity that makes us who and what we are.
You've been an active member of the survivor community, president of the Illinois Holocaust Museum and Education Center. So what message do you have for young people, children? They weren't around for this. They know only what they read in books or see in movies. What message do you have to share with people so that 50 years from now, they never forget what must never happen again?
You know, the message that we survivors carry and have carried and are here for a reason to it's called education. This is what we do best at the Illinois Holocaust Museum and Education Center. I must say, we have not learned from the past. We humanity, has not learned from the Holocaust. If you look around of what is happening in the world today, the hatred, the bigotry, the anti-Semitism that is still out there for every single person that looks different than I do or you do. So I think we need to remember the past. I think we need to educate. I think we need to read. I think we need to remember, because yesterday it happened to me and my people. Tomorrow it could happen to you and your people. And if we forget, we have not done our job.
And that's why, Fritzi Fritschel, I'm so happy that you have taken the time to share your story, not just with me, but with everybody who listens to this podcast, who probably is sitting with mouth open in shock for what you had to deal with, but in awe for the courage and the honor that you live with today and ever since that time, so that you can educate and teach others the way life needs to be. You're wonderful. I pray that you are blessed for many years to come, and I thank you for sharing your story.
And I thank you for doing the story, because it is so important, and you realize the importance of it. So thank you again.
You're most welcome. Thank you. One aspect of understanding the power of the Holocaust, of course, is to hear the stories of survivors and what they lived through, which is unimaginable to us to even perceive. But the reason they tell the story is because they want people to be educated and understand that there has to be a future, that we must learn from our past, even though sometimes we look around the world and we're not sure that we do. There is one very significant effort that makes that attempt to teach from the past so that we can look in a positive light to the future, and that is the Illinois Holocaust Museum and Education Center, located in Skokie, Illinois, something I saw pretty much when it opened, and it's doing so well. Joining me now to talk about the programs and why you should go visit this Museum and Education Center is Shoshana Buchholz-Miller. She's the Vice President of Education and Exhibitions, and Shoshana, you're the perfect person to talk to. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having me.
Let me start with the general question. For people that say, you know, I'm uncomfortable going to the Holocaust Museum and Education Center. I don't want my kids to see this. I don't want, you know, this is just an evil part of our history. We should never talk about this and just let's forget it happened. Why should we come to the museum and center?
I think there are a number of answers to that question. And I think the first is that if we, as many people know, if we don't understand our past, then we are doomed to repeat it. We need to be able to learn from what happened and all the people who have that reaction, the reaction of that it's painful and hard. They're correct. The Holocaust was a horrible time in history, but it is so important for us to understand what happened so that we can make informed decisions as citizens and we can make informed choices as people and neighbors, so that we can prevent these kinds of things from happening again. So it's so important for people to come and learn that story. And we tell that. That's the raison d'etre of the museum, is for us to be able to educate people about the past. But I think one of the misconceptions that people have before they come to the museum is that, oh, it's going to be so hard, it's going to be so depressing. And I think that, yes, it is a powerful and moving and meaningful place, but I think by the end, what we find is visitors really end feeling a certain upliftedness, because there have been people who have taken action. They learn about people who've made a difference. They learn about people being upstanders and feel inspired themselves about the importance of taking action and being an upstander. And that's another such a crucial element of people coming to see, to visit the museum and learn about the history.
One of the things I remember, cool, when I first saw it, you look at it even from the outside, half of it is dark and half of it is light. And that's by architectural design, isn't it?
That's correct, yes. In fact, you know, we're very proud and honored to have an architecturally significant museum built by Stanley Tigerman, a renowned architect. And in fact, people are so interested in the architecture, and there's so much meaning that is imbued in every element of the museum that we have architecture tours that we give regularly. And they are very well attended because it's so interesting to learn the meaning behind the different elements, whether it's the light, the dark side of the building that you enter in and the light side that you leave, or the fact that as you're walking through our Holocaust exhibition and things are, and you're learning about how things are becoming worse in Europe, you're beginning to descend as you walk, and you may not realize it at first, but then you begin to understand you're getting lower and lower. So there are a lot of really interesting elements to the museum, and it's something that we really like to highlight for our visitors.
I want to talk about special exhibits, but first there are permanent things people will always see. If we go to the museum, what are the most important components of our walkthrough that, that teach us the lessons of the past? I mean, for example, I know there's a boxcar there that, that transported the Jews to the concentration camps.
Right. So we have our core exhibition, our main exhibition is the Karkomi Holocaust Exhibition, and that takes visitors on a journey through the history of the 1930s to the end of the war and post-war years. And really there are, that exhibition is filled with different artifacts that highlight what was happening at that time. You identified the boxcar as being a core component of the exhibition. It really is in the middle of the exhibition and symbolizes the full experience of the Holocaust. But I think another element that is really interesting for people to understand is that the vast majority of our artifacts were given to us by local survivors that live in Skokie and the Chicagoland area. And so people are able to really follow the stories of different survivors who came here and made a life for themselves after the war and understand what happened in the war through those personal stories. And it's important for us that visitors see that the numbers in the Holocaust are so hard to understand. They're really unfathomable, but really it's one person at a time. And so being able to learn those individual stories, which they can as they go through the exhibition, are so important and meaningful.
And of course, the museum's location in Skokie is not random. I mean, I grew up there, and so I was I grew up in a neighborhood of Holocaust survivors, and of course, a heavy concentration of Holocaust survivors landed in Skokie, and so it's a good place for the museum to be. It was their home.
No, it's extremely meaningful that it was here. I mean, the museum in its current form has been around for 7 years, but it started many years before that in a small storefront on Main Street in Skokie, and we're proud to have been able to have built this beautiful building. And we really have the survivors in Skokie to thank for that, because they are the ones that decided to speak out in the 70s when neo-Nazis threatened to march in Skokie, and that really prompted them and inspired them to become what we say as upstanders, to speak out, to make a difference, and then became inspired to build this institution so that for generations people are able to learn this story and be able to apply it to the present day.
I remember that morning when the Nazis were going to march, and my neighbors, who were all very peaceful people, really rose up in arms that day. Mm-hmm. They were going to beat those Nazis, and of course the Nazis never showed, but that's probably a topic for another time. But I want to talk about the exhibits, but I really want to talk about something permanent that's in development, that right now is in its pilot stage, because one of the things that makes me sad is that the most powerful way to keep this story alive is through the mouths and the stories of these survivors. And Shoshana, we're losing them. They're in their 80s and their 90s, and they're dying every day. You are doing something to maintain those stories forever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really fascinating and exciting part of the work that we're doing, and you're absolutely right. The impetus is that we find, and we know this and studies have shown this, that some of the most impactful parts of Holocaust education are when people hear from survivors themselves. That personal interaction is really crucial and really, as I talked about before, makes that the Holocaust as history come alive as one person's story. And many students, the students that come to visit our museum are lucky to be able to hear from survivors. And the public, if they come on a weekend, are often able to hear from a survivor. But you're right, that is not going to be the case for in just a few short years. And so we really wanted to think creatively about the future. And we have had the privilege of being able to partner with the USC Shoah Foundation in California on a project where we are working with them and currently piloting a interactive survivor recording, something that we call an interactive survivor experience. And what has happened is that the Shoah Foundation has recorded to date one person who we are showing in pilot right now. They recorded him answering 1,800 questions, and they are married that recording with natural language recognition software. So visitors can come and ask this recording a question, and he will answer the visitor as if you're having a conversation. It sounds very futuristic, but we are piloting now. We have His name is Pincus Gutter. He is a survivor from Toronto, and we have him available to the public on Saturdays. And people can come and ask Pincus questions about his experience in the Holocaust, his life after, his life before, and he will answer them. And this is something that, as I said, is a pilot, but we and the Shoah Foundation are expanding this. And so ultimately, there will be 13 such recordings, 7 of which are from survivors that are from the Chicagoland area and affiliated with our museum. And we will be able to show those recordings for generations to come, allowing my children, my grandchildren, my great-grandchildren to have a conversation with a survivor and really feel as if they are having that personal interaction and understanding that personal story.
I think it's so amazing and such a reflection of technology today, because I know there are, I mean, the Shoah Foundation has created, listen, I remember going to the movie theater and seeing that, what was it, 20 hours over a couple of days? Really, there's a movie called Shoah, and it goes on for about 20 hours, and it is the stories of survivors telling their stories. But what's different, what's a reflection of at least modern day needs, is what you're doing, which is let people ask questions and really feel as though the survivor's talking back to them even when the day comes and they're gone.
And we've really found in the pilot process that people feel that it is such a real interaction that they will often ask us, wait, can he see us? Is he in Toronto in his home? It feels like it's Skyping with my grandpa. It's such a, because people are so used to communicating through screens these days, it has such a natural and real feel to it.
Yeah. I want to talk about a couple of the temporary exhibits, and they're there for a period of time. There's one that's playing through the summer, and this is fantastic. I mean, it's for sports fans. You don't want to miss this, an incredible part of the role of the Holocaust as it played out in the Olympics.
Yeah, so we are currently hosting Nazi Olympics Berlin 1936 as a special exhibition, and it is perfectly timed because of the August Olympics this year. And I think, you know, it really gives a lot of the history of the 1936 Olympics. It explains something that I didn't know before, which is that actually the modern-day Olympics, what we think of as the Olympics with the torch run and all the pageantry, was actually created by the Nazis. This was the 1936 Olympics was their opportunity to really show the world what a wonderful and powerful place they were, and so they invested in that pageantry. And so the exhibition shows the history of that time. It highlights Jackie Robinson. Mack Robinson, Jackie Robinson's brother, Jesse Owens, a number of the athletes who were gold medal winners, which was really a disappointment to Hitler, because he had such an image of what the superior Aryan race would be. So we are really excited about that and have a number of programs related to that, but also the exhibition running through the course of the Olympics through the end of August.
Fantastic. And then come the fall, a new exhibit that focuses in on women, another lesson to learn.
Yeah, so at the Holocaust Museum, we are very much committed to educating people on the history of the Holocaust and its lessons, and it's, and the lessons and how they impact the present day are very important to us as well. And so we do exhibitions that focus on elements of the Holocaust, but we also go broader than that and look at other human rights issues. So we have a new exhibition coming up called Women Hold Up Half the Sky. It's based on a book by Nicholas Kristof and his wife Cheryl Wu Dunn called Half the Sky, and it really focuses on women in the developing world and the women and girls and the challenges they face in the developing world, and also the solutions that exist for addressing those challenges. So it looks at difficult issues like gender-based violence, like trafficking, like maternal health, and what problems women and girls face and how they can be resolved. And not only looking at it from the developing world angle, but we also are bringing in stories from our local community. We're partnering with the YWCA North Shore Evanston to present the exhibition. We're going to have a wealth of programming about those women and girls issues and what people can do at home and what they can think about globally in terms of supporting women and girls in those issues.
People need to come to see the museum. I did a special on this for the Comcast Network when you guys first opened, called Site of Remembrance, Emmy Award winning, I might add. And
well, congratulations.
Well, very proud of it, and sat with J.B. Pritzker and Fritzy Fritschel, Sam Harris, and so many of the key people there, Rick Hirschhaut at the time. And you're talking about what the mission was going to be. And one of the things I learned from that, and even the museum in Washington, D.C., it's not about coming in just to learn about the past. What's important, especially for young people, you need to learn about the past because, look, the Holocaust didn't start with a concentration camp. That's not how this began. It began with mm-hmm. rhetoric, and it began mm-hmm. with problems in the world. And before you know it, rhetoric takes over, and then actions come into play. It's really about preventing this for the future, so that we can mm-hmm. monitor what's happening in the world.
Mm-hmm. No, that's absolutely true. I mean, I think a lesson that we try to teach is that democracy is fragile and that each of us has a responsibility to take care of others and to be thoughtful about the words and the actions that we do. And that is something that didn't end in 1945, and unfortunately genocide didn't end in 1945. We spend time educating people about what happened in Bosnia, what happened in Cambodia, what's happening currently to the Yazidis in Syria. And we're sad to have to do it, but we want to remind people that we still have this responsibility to understand the impact of our words and actions.
Everybody owes it to themselves to go to the Illinois Holocaust Museum and Education Center. The website is ilholocaustmuseum.org, right? Ilholocaustmuseum.org. And the address up in Skokie?
9603 Woods Drive.
Okay, which is a little off the beaten path, but you get off at Old Orchard Road and you're right there.
That's right.
And you'll find it very quickly. Shoshana Buchholz-Miller, thank you. I urge people to go to the website and check you guys out. Wait for that interactive project as it grows and develops. It's going to be amazing. Check out the exhibits now. It may be one of the most important treasures in the Chicagoland area that takes history and points us towards a more positive future. Thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more insider scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.